This Restorative Justice Life is a production of Amplify RJ. Follow us on all social media platforms at Amplify RJ, sign up for our email list, and check out our website at amplifyrj.com to stay up to date on everything we have going on. Make sure you're subscribed to this feed on whatever platform you're listening on right now so you don't miss an episode. And finally, we'd love it if you left us a rating and review. It really helps us literally amplify this work. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the episode. Welcome to This Restorative Justice Life, the podcast that explores how the philosophy, practices, and values of restorative justice apply to our everyday lives. I'm your host, David Ryan Barcega Castro Harris, all five names for the ancestors, and I'm the founder of Amplify RJ. On this podcast, I talk with RJ practitioners, circle keepers, and others doing this work about how this way of being has impacted their lives. Marlon, welcome to This Restorative Justice Life. Who are you?
I am an African-American male who was directly impacted by the criminal justice system.
Who are you?
I'm a husband and father to 8 kids.
Who are you?
I am a leader who really believes in collective leadership.
Who are you?
A person of faith who believes in Black liberation theology.
Mm-hmm. Who are you?
A person who believes in the value of mental health and therapy.
Who are you?
A student of life who believes in learning and has a passion for learning.
Who are you?
An organizer who believes in building relationships and developing leaders.
Mm-hmm. We're going to get to the intersections of all of those things and dive into This Restorative Justice Life in just a moment.
Hey folks, I'm Elise, your producer, and today we are welcoming Marlon Chamberlain as our guest today. You are in for such a treat because Marlon is an advocate for people directly impacted by the justice system. Marlon brings over 20 years of lived and professional experience to his work at the Heart Alliance and many other initiatives. In order to interact more deeply with the content that we're putting out through This Restorative Justice Life, you should sign up for our Mighty Networks, where we are having an exclusive podcast discussion group every month and where we post discussion questions after every single episode so that you get to think even deeper to what you listen to. As always, thanks for listening and let's get back into it.
And welcome back, Marlon. So excited to meet you and also have you here. I've heard very many wonderful things about you, and I can't wait to get into some of those things, but it's always good to check in at the beginning of these conversations. So to the fullest extent that you want to answer the question right now, how are you?
I am great. It's been a great week. A lot of positive things happening. We actually have an event tomorrow where we will be bringing folks from all across the state of Illinois together to create language to repeal and replace the 1994 crime bill.
Beautiful. You know, your work organizing, advocacy, so many things stem from, I imagine, your experience directly being impacted by the criminal legal system. Mm-hmm. But I imagine restorative justice as a framework was something that you, even if you didn't have the words for, started for you even before that. So in your own words, how did this journey get started for you?
So you are absolutely right. Like this journey for me, I believe, just even reflecting back, started from when I was a little kid. Mm-hmm. And just watching my grandmother was somebody who believed in the value of relationships. She was a person of faith. She believed in holding folks accountable, but holding folks accountable in love. Mm-hmm. And so that's the culture that I grew up in, to where we understood that when you love somebody, that you hold them accountable, but you also hold them accountable in a way to where you restore them back into community. And so
what did that look like?
So that could look like anything from my grandmother pinching you. And then explaining to you, like, if I did act up in church, my grandmother would pinch me. And then after church, she would sit me down and explain to me, like why she pinched me or why she sort of tapped my hand to say, like, when you're in public or when you're in church, you should pay attention and listen. But she did it in love. And because I knew that my grandmother loved me like dearly, like I was able to receive that. And she allowed me an opportunity to also sort of share like my experience and talk about how sometimes in church I was bored. And so she allowed me an opportunity to sort of like almost argue my position. But at the end, she would win. But the way that she would discipline me would always be in love.
Right. And that discipline word, right? Discipline isn't punishment. Discipline is teaching.
Absolutely.
Right. And I know that trips people up in many circumstances. You saw that from your grandma growing up. How else did these kinds of relational ways of being manifest for you as a young person?
So it's funny because even when I ventured out into the streets, the sort of like my, I guess you would say, like just the people that I associated with, like we would fall out sometimes. And the way that we would sort of resolve conflict was done in a restorative way. Like we didn't result to violence in every argument or every sort of like moment of conflict. There were times when we actually talked things out. And I just think about also my experience in prison was very restorative in a sense to where I saw men communicate with each other and listen to each other in an environment and place that people traditionally wouldn't expect to see this. And so for me, I think all throughout my life, even when I couldn't put sort of like words to what was happening, the more and more I learned about restorative justice, I realized that I had been practicing some of the skills of restorative justice, but just didn't know it.
Yeah. Again, I'm curious if there's an example that comes to mind, because people don't think of prisons as incredibly restorative places. I imagine you're talking more about the interactions between fellow people who are detained instead of, you know, the systems and structure that put those places, right?
Absolutely. 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 Absolutely.
Are there examples that you want to highlight?
Yeah. So an example that I would give in the federal prison system. So each sort of like they call them cars, and a car is simply like you and the state to where you're from. And so that's how people sort of associate with each other. So if you were new on the compound or at the institution, people would direct you to a specific car based on your state. And what would happen is that representatives from different states, if there was an issue, different representatives would come together and say, hey, let's talk this out before people result to violence or fighting or whatever it may be. People would come together and resolve conflict. And so there were many occasions. I mean, as you can imagine, we lived with each other. Like we were around people 24/7 with no way of sort of like going off to like yourself. Mm-hmm. And so there will be situations that happen around the TV, the phone, the weightlifting like equipment, and people would talk it out and really sort of almost form a circle to talk through like the conflict. And then I would also say I would also give an example of like how we use circles. Like what we would do is that when people would be getting ready to transition out or go home, we would have a circle to celebrate the person. And so we would all gather in a circle and we would all go around in the circle and talk about what we've learned from that person. And then also give them sort of like some words of advice as they transition out of the system. And so those are just two examples of how like we used restorative justice practices without even knowing that that's what we were doing.
Right. Without even knowing the words. These ways of being, right, being interconnected, building relationships, repairing relationships when there's Absolutely. harm, is something that we all have within us. We've talked a lot on this podcast about, you know, learning about restorative justice, quote unquote, like formally, isn't really about learning something new. It's about a rekindling of truth that we have inside of us. It's a remembering. It's in some ways restoring ourselves to being in right relationship with, you know, self and others. And so, you know, it's not surprising to me, and probably not surprising to most of the people who are listening to this, who are already oriented towards justice and prison abolition and advocacy for people who are impacted by the criminal legal system. You know, when people are put in community like this, we do have the ability to solve problems together. We don't need the state to get involved. We don't need the state to hand down punishments for situations that, you know, don't necessarily necessitate punishment. They necessitate support, or they necessitate a conversation between two people or two parties that the state has nothing to do with. To the extent that you're comfortable sharing, I'm curious, in your reimagination of your encounters with the criminal legal system, how could things have been different?
Oh, good question. I was on a panel this Monday at Lake Forest College, and I was asked the same question. And all throughout my sort of prison experience, or even just my experience of living sort of like a criminal lifestyle, like at no point did anyone ever ask me why, like I was hustling, like at any point. And I think if someone would have sat down and genuinely ask me, why do you keep going back to selling drugs? I think that would have changed my life. Because at the time, like I was expecting my first child. I didn't grow up in relationship with a good relationship with my father. And so that was added sort of anxiety and pressure. And so I made a bad decision to sell drugs. But if someone would have intervened and just said, hey, can I sit down and I really want to understand, like, why you keep, you know, going back to selling drugs? I think to me, that would have allowed me to open up and share sort of like my experience of what I was going through and would have been open to receive help.
Yeah. Can you articulate a why in this moment?
So at that time, I felt like that was the only choice that I had, because I sought out counsel from several people and really didn't get any help. And I also asked my father, like, what should I do? Like, at the time, the mother of my two oldest kids was pregnant, and my father basically told me to leave her. And that was advice that I knew just in my gut, it just didn't sit well with me. And so what I saw in the environment of where I grew up is that people made it happen, whether illegally or legal. You made it happen. And to me at that time is what I saw as like, that is what a man should do. And so I made a decision based off of what I knew, the sort of like the associations that I had, and this sort of false like narrative of that whatever you do what you have to do to take care of your kids, is what I was sort of operating from. Now, looking back, I know that if I would have just taken my time and said, okay, Marlon, career-wise, what can you do now to begin to set yourself up to move into a career and to be the father who you want to be there for your son. Like, I could have made some different decisions, but my network was small. My thinking was small. And I made a decision based on the here and now without sort of looking at the long-term effects of what that decision would sort of the life that it would lead me to.
Yeah. And so what I hear in that is that you needed guidance, you needed options, you needed opportunity, you needed Absolutely. Support. And when you got caught up in the legal system, the solution was, no, you're going to go away.
Absolutely.
And hope you learn your lesson.
Absolutely.
Right. And again, people who are listening to this podcast are probably already oriented towards the criminal legal system does not meet the needs of anybody impacted, right?
Not
either
at
the
all.
People who cause harm. And when you're talking about selling drugs, you can talk about how communities are harmed or the people who you're selling to are harmed, but that's still not really meeting the needs of anybody involved by removing one person from the cycle of you know, the illicit drug trade in
absolutely
in the United States or in Illinois specifically. Somewhere along the way, I don't know if it was while you were still in prison or after you got out, you discovered or were enlightened to the word restorative justice. When was that, and what was that experience like for you?
So I would say this, going into the system when I was arrested on this on my federal case, the day that I was arrested, like I knew I was tight. I was ready to get out the game. And the day that I was arrested, going into the system, I went into the system with a different mindset. Mm-hmm. I think there were a couple moments that shifted for me, but one that I remember specifically, especially after I started to learn more about restorative justice, was I was in a program, and the program that I was in, if someone in our unit did something, the entire unit sort of suffered the consequences of whatever the action, the infraction was. And I remember complaining about this. And I remember one of the sort of treatment specialists calling me out, but really he called me in because he called me into community. And what he said to me was, he said, "Marlon, how do you think your daughter feels when she's at cheerleading practice and she looks in the stands and everybody else's father is there and you're not there to support her?" And he gave an example of how, like, my son, if he was at football games, like, was suffering the consequences of my decisions. And it wasn't a call out, it was a call in, because what it taught me the value of community and how my decisions impact the community. And so I think for me, that was my introduction to sort of like RJ practices. But since I've been home, I've been through several RJ trainings where I spent the week in community with folks. And it was just an experience of that I had never experienced, because for one, it's almost like it forces you to listen. Because if you don't have the talking piece, you're forced to really listen in a way that I wasn't used to. So I was forced to actively listen to people. And then also make connections, because during the rounds of like how you sort of like enter into circle, you begin to build relationships before you jump into whatever it is. If there's an issue that you want to address, if this is a circle of celebration, you build relationships first. And then you go into like the celebratory parts of the circle. And so I would say it started when I was incarcerated, but since I've been home, we incorporated RJ principles into like I was doing violence prevention work. And part of what we did was we incorporated the principles into our like day-to-day operations, the curriculum, how we interacted with participants, how we interacted with staff. And so we built that into our culture. And so I would say it started on the inside. And then once I was released from prison, just being introduced to the actual skills that you can build from the RJ work was really sort of infused in the culture of all of the work that we did in violence prevention work.
Yeah. How did you enter that field, right? Because the transition out of prison is not an easy one for anybody. What were the supports available to you? Who were the people that you want to shout out? What was that journey like?
So I would definitely say my family, first and foremost. Like, my family was very supportive, very forgiving. I didn't feel like they were holding like my mistake over my head. Like, they were very supportive. I would also shout out Eddie Bocanegra, who was the one who introduced me to advocacy work and the Community Renewal Society, who taught me like the value of organizing and the congregations that were a part of CRS. I would say that the support that I received from family and friends is what really helped me during my transition period. But I didn't initially start off doing violence prevention work. I started off doing organizing work. Mm-hmm. And then after 3 years transitioned into sort of like the violence prevention work. And so there's a lot of people that, Michelle Day being one of them, who really sort of like invested a lot of time and energy and mentoring me around just like restorative justice practices. And so like just the support from family, friends, and multiple people who have invested in my leadership in this work, and Keith Lewis. I mean, it's a bunch of people I could name.
Yeah. And, you know, the subtle thing that I'm trying to get at is like, who are the people that you want to invite on this podcast who are formative in that? So we'll circle back to that later. But, you know, as you were doing the organizing work, as you were doing the community violence prevention work, mm-hmm. not violence interruption, right?
Violence prevention work. Yeah,
violence prevention. You talked about how RJ was infused in that. What did that look like within the context of those programs?
So in the violence prevention work, we would start all of our meetings with a check-in. We were creative in some of our questions when we would start meetings to be more intentional about like just the relational aspects of the work and the value of being in right relationship with staff and participants, because we were working with perpetrators and victims of gun violence. Mm-hmm. And so
I'll say like are often the same people.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yep. We would also, so our sort of like disciplinary like process, like we infused RJ principles, meaning if somebody broke a rule, we didn't just suspend folks like that. Like there would be consequences, but the way that we would restore people back into the program was we would use RJ practices. Like we would have a circle with the person that was harmed and the person who initially may have caused the harm, and we would talk through it. And then that person would be restored back into the program. And then we wouldn't hold it over their head. Like once we made amends and we talked through it, that person was restored. And then we would also sort of in the circle talk about like what supports are needed to make sure, like if it was an example would be, let's say one of the rules was you had to be in the program by 9:15. Mm-hmm. If you were late three times or more, you may be suspended for one day. And then when we would have this circle, one of the things that we would talk about is, are you having transportation issues? Like, how can we support you to make sure that you can get here on time? And so we would get to the why. It wasn't just, okay, let's punish this person, let's kick them out the program. It was really around, how can we help support you? If it was a fight, we would bring both parties together, or if there were brawls, which there were, we had, you know, different folks from different mobs from all over Inglewood. We would of course break up the fight, and then we would try to bring both sides together to say, can we sit down and talk about what happened, and then process that together. And then we would do this before they actually left like the program site, because what we also knew is that if individuals left that program site and went back into community without resolving the issue, that it could spill over into the community. And so we would separate individuals, we would talk to them, and then initially we would say, hey, can we bring everyone together? We would give them an opportunity to say yes or no. And in most cases, they said yes, because we had created those relationships where they trusted us. And so we would bring both all of the individuals together. We would talk through it. But then we would also talk about, in instances where this happens again, how could we handle this in a different way? And I would say in 9 out of 10, like, situations when this happened, we were able to talk through it to where they were able to shake hands. Now, I'm not saying that they walked away best of friends, but they shook hands and agreed that it wouldn't carry over into the streets. And then they will come back to work together. I mean, come back to programming the next day, and we would have peace.
Yeah. Without going into specifics of any one situation, right? Confidentiality. What did you often identify as like the root causes of these kinds of conflicts?
So I would say what we would hear from them is, mm-hmm. is respect or mm-hmm. disrespect. And so whenever they would, like if it was a situation where someone felt disrespected, things would escalate. And it could be something as simple as, you sat in my chair. Or you accidentally kicked my foot. So it just depends. If they were working together and one person wanted to be the lead for the day and they were told that they couldn't be the lead, it would just be little things that would sort of escalate into other things. Or there would be situations where it was something that happened in the streets before programming and they would see each other. And this would be the first time that they've been in like close proximity, and then things would escalate.
Yeah. And I think that speaks so much to the need for the relationship building even more, right? When you have a relationship with someone, you can say, "Hey man, you're in my seat."
Absolutely.
Right. Or like, "Oh, I'm sorry. I kicked your leg. My bad. It's all good." You know? Absolutely. And so restorative justice, not just being about that repair of harm process, but what are the Absolutely. Things that we can do to make sure that we have relationships rooted in respect, right? Rooted in trust, rooted in equity, to make sure that we're preventing that kind of harm from happening
Absolutely.
In the first place.
Absolutely. I would also add a space to heal, because mm-hmm. what we also saw this a lot, is that when things would happen, whether it was family related, if we lost a participant, like we would have circles to talk about it. And that's not something that you normally see. Like when things happen in the street, like folks are not processing like, "Man, I love this person. And now they're no longer here." And so we created space to cry and to reassure folks that it's okay. Like being sad is a normal emotion that you can process and really talk through like what this loss or this person meant to you. So we created space for that, which is how you sort of like resolve trauma or you learn to manage trauma. And so we created that space where folks were comfortable to be vulnerable and to say, "Man, I love this guy. And now this guy is no longer here." So we also created space for individuals to heal.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so important to do that work on an individual level with people. And now a lot of your work has shifted to policy to prevent all of these kinds of things from happening in the first place, changing the conditions under which, you know, the criminal legal system impacts our people. Tell us about all of your organizing work, some of the campaigns that you're doing.
Absolutely. So the Fully Free campaign is a multi-year statewide campaign to end permanent punishments for individuals with arrest or conviction records. And we intentionally decided to use the word permanent punishments and not collateral consequences, because collateral suggests that these laws were accidental. And we don't believe that they were accidental. And so we've been able to launch this campaign in 12 cities across the state, the state of Illinois. And these were all led by directly impacted individuals. And the way that I sort of describe the campaign is like in three buckets. One, we want to build collective power, statewide collective power, meaning this movement is not led by one person. I'm not the leader of this movement. There are hundreds of leaders that are helping us lead this movement. And so we want to continue hosting events where we can recruit, identify, and develop new leaders that are directly impacted to help us lead this work. The second bucket is we want to build relationships with our local media outlets. And so the folks in Southern Illinois are looking to build relationships with radio stations, news outlets, the newspapers, because we want to influence the media. We want people to see a different side of individuals who have been incarcerated or who are living with an arrest record, because the media sort of portrays people that have been to prison as if we're these monsters. And so we want to humanize the issue. The third bucket is we want to build relationships with our elected officials. And so when we introduce policy, we can then educate our legislators on how these hundreds of permanent punishments are impacting people across the state. Our data shows that there's an estimated 3.3 million people in Illinois that are living with an arrest or conviction record. And so that is the demographic of folks that we want to go after to really help equip them and enable them to act for their own liberation. And so this campaign is not just about eliminating policy, but it's also about let's humanize the issue and let's use facts and data to talk about real public safety that doesn't restrict or hinder or create barriers, but it creates opportunities and creates resources so that people can be restored back into community.
Can you define public safety in your vision?
My definition of public safety is opportunities and resources. And so we know that the data shows that permanent punishments primarily impact or disproportionately impacts communities, Black and Brown communities. And so what we want to do is we want to level the playing field. The same resources and opportunities that people have on the north side of Chicago or in certain communities across the state, we want everyone to have those same opportunities. And so this is about equity. It's about tearing down the barriers that certain people face in certain communities and creating a world where everyone has an opportunity. And it's also preventative, because if we remove a lot of these barriers, we could prevent people from even going into the system in the first place. Right. I always say that recidivism is a reflection of the system, not an individual. And so when individuals go back into the system after they've been released, that is a failure of the system, not the individuals.
Right. When I think about, opportunity and supports, right? So many times when people come out, there are no supports, or there are very limited supports. There are very limited opportunities. And I know that there's been legislation over the years, like things like Ban the Box, where you can no longer ask, like, have you been convicted of a felony on job applications, and, you know, giving people a little bit more opportunity in that way. But even things like student loans, things like access to housing, access to other support, like, are restricted for people who have been directly impacted by the criminal legal system in those ways. Is that also a part of what you're organizing for?
Absolutely. So to give you a concrete example, this year we introduced a bill called the FREE Act. And it's the Families Estate Equity Act, the FREE Act. And basically what this bill does is it removes the language from the 1975 Probate Act that restricts individuals with felony convictions from being an executor or administrator over an estate. Mm-hmm. An example, my father last year passed away in March. He appointed me as his executor. But because I have a 25-year-old conviction, I wasn't able to carry out the wishes of my father because of my background. Mm-hmm. And so we introduced this bill to remove the restriction that would allow over 600,000 people in Illinois to carry out the wishes of their family members. And so we've done a lot of just legislative research where we actually looked at the entire Illinois code and statutes to identify all of these hundreds of barriers. And we'll have information and really have a memo, and we'll begin to downpour this information or download this information into our leaders, because what we want to do is take away the vague sort of term of barriers. Like, we'll have specific language, mm-hmm. just like I'm saying the Probate Act is restricting individuals from being an executor or administrator. We'll have specific language to each barrier so that we can be more specific, because right now, there are blanket barriers, meaning no matter what the conviction is, if you have a felony conviction on your record, there are certain industries, whether it's housing, employment, et cetera, that just completely bars everyone.
This is work that is restorative in nature, in that it's like correcting wrongs, changing policy. I think in some ways, you know, you want to ask for more, right? Like, for the people who these policies have harmed, what are the reparations for that? Is that a part of what you're asking for? Is that too pie in the sky?
No, it's not too pie in the sky. I think that's about equity and fairness. So absolutely, mm-hmm. we're asking for reparations, and reparations could be just like they were, the government was giving out stimulus checks during the pandemic. We're saying that that is the type of reparations, whether it's free college education or free college tuition, whether it's monthly checks. But we are, like, a part of our strategy is to ask for those reparations for the harm that has been done to our communities.
I think a lot about, you know, people think about restorative justice just between, like, oh, one person did this to this person and we repair. But right, the systems have caused this harm, right? And of course, we want the systems to stop causing that harm, right? So absolutely, like, eliminate those harmful policies. But, like, what does it mean for the systems and the actors that control those systems to actually do things that address the needs that their harm has caused? There's so much in there. What is the opposition that you're running into?
So this year with the Free Act, the opposition that we're running into is people are asking about, like, well, what about people who committed financial crimes? And our position is that we believe in all of us or none, meaning that we won't negotiate in a way to where we leave certain folks out, regardless of the conviction. And then I would also say some of the opposition has just been when we talk about the fact that one of the core sort of principles of the campaign is that a criminal record or conviction shouldn't follow anyone for life, no matter the conviction. Some people are uncomfortable with hearing that. And the first thing that folks want to name is, well, what about people who committed violent offenses or people who have committed sex offenses? And our position is that that pathway to living a fully free lifestyle may be different depending on the conviction, but that everyone should have a pathway to being able to be fully free. Now, I was just going to close with saying, and some people are uncomfortable with that.
Yeah, they're, I think, in the maybe more liberal, I'll say liberal ideas of, like, criminal legal system reform, right? Oh, the nonviolent drug offenders, let's, like, you know,
yep.
let's take things away that will allow them to have, like, better opportunities. But it's not just that, right? Uh-uh. We're trying to dismantle all of it.
Absolutely.
And again, it's not about, like, letting people off the hook for the things they've done, but, like, you know, people do things for a reason, right?
Absolutely.
And what are the supports that they can be given to make better choices moving forward? What are the barriers that we can eliminate from them to help them, to make it easier to make choices that'll benefit them and their communities? You know, one of the reasons that we have you here is that not only are you doing great work in Chicago and community in Illinois across the board. You're going to be highlighting some of this at the NACRJ conference, which is July 7 through 9, with a pre-conference day on July 6. And, you know, everybody who's listening to this, we definitely would love to see you there. What is it that you'll be sharing at the conference?
Really just more about the Fully Free campaign, given sort of like an overview of what some of the hundreds of barriers that currently, like, exist, like how they impact people across the state, the demographics of folks that are being impacted by these permanent punishments, but then also talking about, like, what we believe is a strategy to eliminate these permanent punishments. And so it will really be me just giving a general overview of the campaign and talking more around about how people can get involved in the work that we do. And I do just want to say this, because I also just think about, like, people, the systems, so-called, we're sent to prison to be rehabilitated. Mm-hmm. And folks go to prison, they serve their time of incarceration, they complete all of the stipulations of parole, probation. But I think where a lot of people, like, maybe just a little ignorant to, is that people think that once you're home, it's over. And no matter what, like, even after you complete all of the stipulations and you complete, you finish probation and parole and you go back to school and you get your master's degree and you do all of these wonderful things, there are still barriers. And we call it the prison after prison, where people live with a lot of these sort of like barriers for life. And so we're going to also just talk about how how this impacts people, and how this sort of like strips the dignity of individuals that are directly impacted to where people feel ashamed. Mm-hmm. And we want people to feel liberated. Fully Free is about moving out of bondage and moving into a space to where I'm no longer ashamed of the fact that I made a mistake. And we want to restore the dignity of individuals that have an arrest or conviction record. And so we're going to just talk about like the impacts, but then also offer individuals an opportunity to get involved in what we believe this movement is about, which is really creating real public safety and creating opportunities for people that are coming home from prison.
Yeah, the beautiful thing about NACRJ and conferences like this is people come not only from all over the country, but all over the world. There's a wonderful exchange of ideas, but that doesn't necessarily just happen at a conference. What are some models or things that you've seen in other places in the country that you're drawing inspiration from?
I would say a couple things. So there is a campaign called the Time Done campaign that is being led by the Alliance for Safety and Justice that is really centered around saying that at what point can a person move forward in life? Mm-hmm. Very similar to Fully Free. I would also say the Clean Slate work, Clean Slate legislation, which is really giving individuals an opportunity to have their record automatically expunged after a certain amount of time. So there are several sort of campaigns that are happening across the country right now that we constantly sort of brainstorm and think through, like, what's working where? How is this working here? And so we trade ideas. And then there's also a couple movements, the All of Us Are None, that's happening. There's chapters all across the country that are doing organizing work, whether it's around restoring voting rights or creating opportunities for individuals. So there's a lot of great work happening across the country. And I'm excited to be connected to all of these networks, because what it does for me is it gives me an opportunity to learn and pick the brains of people that have been in this work longer than I have.
Yeah, absolutely. And for people who, there are many people who are in Illinois who listen to this just because of my Chicago roots in this work, but they're also a national audience. And I think we got some Canada, some Australia, some Europe as well. How can people who aren't necessarily in Illinois support Fully Free?
So absolutely. Folks can go to our website to sign up to receive campaign action alerts and campaign updates. You can also make donations to the campaign to help. And what I would say is any donation that is made to this campaign is invested in centering the leadership and expertise of those that are directly impacted. And so to give a concrete example of how donations help support this campaign is this last legislative session, we were able to bring leaders down, whether it was on the train or just being able to reimburse folks for gas money to come down to participate, to lobby legislators in support of legislation that helps us. But those are just ways that people can get involved that are not necessarily from Illinois. In Illinois, is you can make a donation, and then you can also invite us out, because we would love to take this campaign across the country and help folks sort of organize and talk through like the steps that we took to start the campaign here in Illinois.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the links to everything, the way to get in touch, the campaign information, that'll all be in the show notes. We've talked a lot about the way that this is manifested in your professional life. I'm curious how restorative justice has impacted you as a person, as Marlon, living life in the world, Marlon, the father, the partner, the friend, the brother, son.
Absolutely. So I would say it's helped me forgive myself. And just learning this process, like the word restorative, like as someone who has been to prison, was gone 10 and a half years away from my kids, like I came home with a lot of guilt and shame of just like knowing that I wasn't able to be invested and involved in my children's life. And so it's allowed me to sort of like to forgive myself and to say like, oh, it's okay, Marlon, like you made a mistake, and moving forward, like you have an opportunity to rebuild those relationships. And it's not something that's going to happen overnight. It's something that you have to continue to plant seeds and make investments and be consistent in rebuilding those relationships that I lost time on. I would also say that even in my family, like with my wife, like in the way that we have conversations or how we sort of like talk with the kids, like we try to, but every night we try to form a circle to pray together or to hear from each other. On birthdays, we sit in a circle and we go around and we talk about what we appreciate about each other or what we like or admire about each other. And so there's just little things or little like skills or just practices that I've learned that I've infused in not only just like myself as an individual, but just into like how we interact with each other as a family.
Yeah, no, that's beautiful. Like it's not just the reparative things, right? That's important. And especially when you are repairing that relationship with yourself, super important. But, you know, the things that you're, like we talked about before, constantly being able to build those relationships, invest in those relationships, they are preventative and in some ways just making peace proactively. You know, we've talked about this Fully Free campaign and what it means for people who've been impacted by the criminal legal system, large scale across the state of Illinois. But for you, Marlon, what does it mean to be fully free?
So to me, to be fully free means to live a life without bondage. And what I mean by bondage is the internal sort of shame and guilt or the stereotypes or the myths that people create about people with records. And so it means to live free of that. It also means to live in communities where opportunities are the norm and resources are the norm. So it means that the sky's the limit, that whatever you put your heart and mind to, that you can achieve. And so people are able to live out their desires, their hopes and dreams and evolve. And so to me, that is what fully free looks like, or living a fully free lifestyle looks like to me.
Yeah.
I always say this. I like to flip the words backwards and say that it means to be free and live fully.
I want to transition into the questions that everybody answers when they come on this podcast. So in your own words, define restorative justice.
I would say right relationship with community.
Mm. Yeah. We've talked about a lot of the ways that happens. You've been doing this work for a while and it hasn't always been smooth sailing, I imagine. What has been an oh shit moment as you've been doing this work, and what have you learned from it?
I would just off the top of my mind, the top of my head, I would say that being in community and being in relationships with just multiple people can be chaotic and complicated. And I think I haven't always, like, I don't always deal with stuff the right way. Or just in general, just in dealing with people. And so I would say that just being in this work, and this work could be overwhelming, and learning how to sort of like separate the work from family life or creating boundaries for me has been challenging. And so I have sort of like these moments all the time, but I'm thankful that I'm able to, like, I have people like in my support network that are here to sort of coach me and to encourage me and to affirm me and pushing forward in the work. But I would just say, just when you have a lot of relationships, sometimes it can be complicated on like, how do you prioritize what relationships and how do you manage being in all of these relationships with people in this work and just in family in general?
Yeah. That's what that brings up for me is like this idea of boundaries. And I'm curious how the boundaries for like taking care of yourself manifest for you.
So that is something that I'm learning and growing. And I think what I'm learning, like, if my birthday is coming up May 5th, and I told my wife, we're actually going to Punta Cana for my birthday, and I'm not taking my computer. Like, I'm not taking anything that would remind me of work. So just being intentional about creating spaces for me to take care of myself, whether it's me going to get a massage or me going to get my nails done or my feet done, but just being intentional and actually planning and putting things on the on my calendar has helped me sort of create these boundaries to take care of myself. So that's what I would say. But I would also say it's a journey. It's not something that I've mastered, because you can't go until you burn out and then decide to do these things. It's just me. It's me trying to be more intentional about creating space for me to sort of like have time for myself.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's a practice for me too. That's why I ask other people how they're doing, because, you know, juggling so many things,
yes.
Can't forget the relationship with yourself. You get to sit in circle with four people, living or dead. Who are they? What is the one question you ask the circle?
Oh, so one, my grandmother. Two, my mom. Three, I would say Malcolm X. And four, I would say Jesus.
All right. And, so you're got the question.
And the question that I would ask is, what is something that you wish you knew, like growing up, that you realize is like something of value or something that could have changed your life?
The fun part about this is now I'm going to turn that question to you. Ooh. So growing up, what's something that you wish you knew that would have been valuable or changed your life?
So for me, it's easy. The appreciation and value of relationships. And the reason why I say that is I lost my mom when I was incarcerated. And if you would have asked me before I went to prison, did I love my mom? I would have told you yes. But what I realize now is that when you appreciate people, you spend time with them. And the streets took me away from my mother moved to Atlanta moved to Atlanta, Georgia. And I would go to Atlanta and spend months and would go see my mother the day before I left, because I would be in the streets partying and putting all of these other things before that relationship. Mm-hmm. And so what I realize now is the value of time and relationships, and you can't take that for granted. And so when you love people, you appreciate, and when you have opportunities to spend time and to learn, like, I wish I could sit with my grandmother and asked her, like, what are some of the things like that you struggle with? Because I saw my grandmother struggle, but I always saw my grandmother push forward. And I never asked, like, how do you do it or what drives you? And so those are the types of questions that I wish I could have that time back to really understand, like, how were they able to hold on to their faith when everything around them looked like it was in chaos? Like, those are the things that I would love to hear them sort of talk to me about.
Yeah, that's a word. That's a word right there. Some ways I want to end just on that, but we have a couple more. We have a couple more. You know, we have hundreds of people listening to us right now, maybe thousands and millions at some point. Nice. Along the way. What is one thing you want everyone listening to this to know? It could be a mantra, it could be an affirmation, it could be something else.
One thing that I would want people to know is that everyone deserves, I don't even want to say a second chance, but a fair chance. And I think for me that, I think that I'm a living example of how people can make mistakes and still rebound and move forward in life and evolve and really live out their dreams. And so the one thing I would want people to know is that we should never give up on people, and give people grace to grow. Give people opportunities to change, because I think sometimes we could look at someone, and because they've made a mistake, even though we may not realize it, we still hold it over their head. I remember, I'm going to close with this. Les Brown, who is a public speaker who I admire, he used to say, if you look at a man as he is, he only can become worse. But if you look at a man in the ways that he could be, then he becomes what he should be. And I believe that. Like, I believe that it starts with how we see and perceive people, and giving people grace to change and to grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Beautiful. You keep coming up with these like really profound things to end on, but there are still two more questions. And we kind of broached this earlier, but who is one person who you think should be on this podcast? And you've got to help me get them on.
One person that should be on this podcast. It's a couple people that come to mind that I think should be on this podcast. I'm going to say Greg Chambers.
Okay.
Very unique story. Served 28 years in prison, and I don't want to tell his story, but I just think he has a unique perspective and could definitely talk about like just restorative justice and what that means to him.
Beautiful. Looking forward to that connect.
Absolutely. And
finally, we've talked about it a little bit, but let's just remind folks, how can people support you, your work, and the ways that you want to be supported?
So the ways that folks can support our work, please go to the website at fullyfree.org and sign up to receive campaign action alerts. And also just get involved. If folks want to reach out to me and schedule a one-on-one, my email address is also on the website. I am a relational person and I love to create space to continue building those relationships. You can make a donation to the campaign. But other than that, just get involved, connect with us and get involved.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Marlon. You've given us some really concrete things to do to support. And you've also given us so many gems through sharing your stories and experiences. Anything else you want to leave the people with?
No, I appreciate this opportunity. I love you all and look forward to building and working together.
Beautiful. Well, everyone else will be back with another episode with someone living this restorative justice life next week. Until then, take care.
Wow. Thank you so much, Marlon. There's so much that we can learn from this episode. I found it to be really impactful. And I think Marlon sits in such an interesting position as someone who has made it through the criminal justice system that is very punitive and doesn't always create pathways for people post-prison. That's one of the main things that he wanted to approach through his restorative practices, because restorative practices means so many different facets of your life need to be restored. Even though you might be restored back to society after serving a sentence, you still have to restore relationships with your family, restore relationships with your community, restore relationships with yourself, and the criminal justice system on its own does not really help with that, especially with job assistance or mental health awareness and trainings. And that's why it is so important to have people like Marlon doing this work. And I think it's important to also ask ourselves, how can we support people who may be incarcerated, and how do we give people a second chance? And like he said in the podcast, not everyone necessarily deserves a second chance, but everyone deserves a fair chance. And that also brings in the intersectionality between race and marginalized communities that are more likely to be put in prison and to be put through these punitive cycles, which means that it is even more important that we are using restorative justice methodology to restore our communities and prevent future harm. As always, thank you so much for listening, and if you are interested in hearing even more discussion prompts and questions, make sure to sign up for our Mighty Networks, which is linked down below, where you can join our exclusive podcast community, where we will be hosting podcast group discussion, which is a great way to support Amplify Restorative Justice and the podcast. As always, thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you next week.
Like what you heard? Please subscribe, rate, review, and share this podcast on whatever platform you're using right now. Or if you're old school, tell a friend. It really helps us further amplify this work.
You can also support us by following us on our social platforms, signing up for our email list, signing up for a community gathering, workshop, or course. So many options. Links to everything in the show notes or on our website, amplifyrj.com. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you next week.